Kani wa kora ni nisete ana ohoru. Crabs dig holes according to the size of their shells. By James Allen McPherson. There was a Christmas morning that first year when something of the outside world intruded into my fortress. I had put up a Christmas tree the evening before and had given it all the life, lights, bulbs, a star, an angel, and gifts that were immediately available to me in this house. You know, Keo, from the early winter you spent here, just how essential this season is to me. When I send Christmas gifts now to my friends there, I like to imagine them floating all over Tokyo, Osaka, Nara, Sendai, Chiba, filtering gently into the homes of my friends like warm winter snow. Nefer called me here on Christmas Day, about 3 years ago, after she had received her gift. She laughed and said, "Santa Claus must have gone crazy." This is when she began calling me Jim-chan. I will admit it, I am childish about the Christmas season. I was once invited to take an inkblot test and was asked to report to the tester the first familiar shapes that came into focus. Out of all the possible combinations of dots that might have constituted buildings, airplanes, cars, the faces and bodies of women and men, I saw only a Christmas tree. Such, apparently, is the importance of this season for me. But on that morning, because I was alone as usual, my plan was to sleep right through Christmas Day, and I was sleeping when the telephone rang. When I answered it, someone said, "My name is Howard Morton. I'm your neighbor across the street. My wife and I have been watching your house. We see you come and go once in a while. Now, we're worried about you. Your Christmas tree lights have been on all night, and we thought that something had happened to cause you not to turn them off. Are you all right? If you need anything, remember, my name is Howard Morton, M-O-R-T-O-N. My wife's name is Laurel. Our telephone number is in the book. Merry Christmas." Beyond a simple expression of the Christmas spirit, Keo, there were several other values encased in this call. There was frugality, wariness, and also compassion. I had noticed this man and his wife across the street, coming and going a number of times. They were white. They were, in terms of the long, hard path I had to walk to this house, no more to me than other. Besides, my own world in those days extended only as far as the mailbox beside my front door. I went back to bed. But later, many months later, I placed this man's call in memory beside the rescue offered by the two brothers in the passing truck, the two beer-bloated white men on the lonely road, the other side of Cedar Rapids, back in the early fall. Both couples, the two in the truck and the two across the street, had offered me a lifeline. After much more thought, many more months later, I began to understand that both lifelines had been extended out of a value bank, an old, obscure value bank rooted in the practical necessities of frontier life. Something is owed to the stranger, any stranger, who seems to be in trouble. This something owed is impersonal, no more than a simple expression of good manners. It is an unconscious habit, not a passion. The Romans called it communitas. Here, the word for it is neighboring. In your language, Keo, the comparable word is giri. But back then, during that first freezing winter in my soul, I just did not care to understand. I focused on patrolling my own habits inside this house. I remained loyal to the ritual base of my own mythology. I controlled, with even greater gloating, my watchful and strict remotion from the life, the animal life, outside my screened bedroom window. Nights in my bed, I still paid careful attention to owls hooting nonchalantly, and then screeching, and field mice and squirrels crying like babies before they died. I watched, in the mornings, the sun touched clean white snow, and very often I could see paw prints of raccoons and the lighter imprints of squirrels, etched into the otherwise pure, idealistically pure, disguise crafted by a benign nature to hide the terrible evidence of how the processes of life, both animal and human, went their way. It was always warm inside that bed, and most nights I would leave the window open, no matter how cold it was outside, and invite the frigid air to drift through my screen and touch my head, and overcome the heat inside the room, so that under my blanket I could generate more, much more, of my own personal, private, unshared warmth. In this way, remotely self-sufficient and gloating, I passed my first winter in this haven of a house. But in the early spring, when the snow had gone away, and when the trees that were once in the backyard I had never explored were once again in bloom, despite all my elaborate patrolling and precautions, and mysteriously in defiance of my screen, one morning something managed to invade my fortress. I awakened to find it crawling on my skin, beneath the blanket, and then it hummed and fluttered and panicked, and then it gave me a vengeful sting in the ass. As always, all windows in the house and even my bedroom door were closed. My bedroom window was, as always, screened. It is still, these many years later, a profound mystery to me, Akoan, just how a spring bumblebee had wormed its way into the very center of the sanctuary I had so carefully constructed around the very outsides of myself, against the magnetic field of outside life. Something was denying me peace, because I had denied it range and meaning.